Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike, and today's interview is with Dennis Pillarinos. Dennis is founder and CEO of Unblocked and was previously founder and CEO of BuddyBuild. He's also been a director at Apple, Amazon, and Microsoft. Welcome, Dennis.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me, Ali. I'm looking forward to it.
I've been excited to have you on the show since it started. You've been on my list of people because we have such great conversations about teams, cultures, products, all the sort of things that the show is about. And I am very confident we will run out of time and still have more fun stuff to talk about.
We'll see.
And so today I want to try to focus our conversation on a lot of things. You've learned a lot about engineering culture, leadership, and products. And you have really, in my mind, a really unique perspective, having built multiple startups, you know, BuddyBuild and now Unblocked, but also worked at some very, very large companies, kind of the top tier in terms of size of tech companies. And so you have this broad set of context that a lot of people don't have. People often grow up in their careers with just kind of one lens that they can talk about culture and teams and all that kind of stuff. So I'd love to dig into that. But first, how do you like to kind of summarize your story up to the point where you founded BuddyBuild? And then we'll kind of take the story from there.
Sure. So yeah, grew up in the Vancouver area, went to school at Simon Fraser University and did 2 degrees, one in computer science, one in business. I'm kind of a self-described, most people would describe me as impatient. And I'm very, very self-aware enough to recognize that I'm a very mediocre developer. And so when I try to build software, I always felt it kind of frustrating. I'm like, why does it have to be this hard? And so I went into building developer tools, I think with that predisposition and that mindset. And so when I was at Microsoft, I worked on the client-side libraries, the .NET framework for a while. And then I thought there was going to be a transition to this, you know, cloud-based type computing. And so spearheaded the effort of one of the kind of the earliest people to think about building a developer API in the cloud, and that became Azure. So we went from, you know, direct connect internet with a machine, like I think it was an HP Compact machine, and a handful of like early adopters who were under some kind of other code name, all the way to geographically distributed data centers around the world, and that became Azure. To give you a sense for how long ago that was when this book-selling company called Amazon started a service, a beta of these services called S3 and EC2. So it was a while ago. They just launched the betas. We just kicked off this project. So I spent a lot of time thinking about developer tools there. One of the things that I think I learned very early in my career is like you really kind of have to optimize for the people that you work with. And so a lot of the folks that I worked with had left Microsoft and gone to other opportunities. And so my time came. I actually moved to San Francisco for a year. Was recruited by AWS to start the office here in Vancouver. So did that. And I had obviously, you know, some experience with cloud and I had a passion for mobile and web. And so they asked me to build the Silk web browser that ships both now the original intent was for the Fire Phone, which lasted for about, I don't know, 27 days or something. And then for the Kindle Fire devices as well. So it's a cloud-powered web browser. And that's what's kind of like what got me up into BuddyBuild.
Awesome. And I like that idea of like, you have to optimize for the people who you work with, when you first said that, I thought you meant you have to contort yourself to deal with the people around who you're working with, but you meant the other way around, find people who you want to work with and find a way to work with great people, which I feel that 100%. Founded BuddyBuild, which I was very lucky to have some of the early experiences with that product. It solved a problem that we had as a mobile development team, getting builds of our apps onto people's phones and even our own phones and running CI and all of that stuff just sucked and tended to really get not prioritized on teams like ours, especially at that time. You came in and you founded this business, BuddyBuild, from idea to success to huge growth to acquisition in like a 3-year pace, which I guess fits with your self-description as impatient. It was not let's plant a seed. And then a decade later, it's like, oh yeah, we're starting to get some growth now. It's just like, let's go. Which is well-suited, I think, to something that's building for mobile in the early, heady, rapid growth days of that space. But so let's kind of dig in a little bit into that process and of you building that business and then how that's reflected in on how now you're building Unblocked, which is relatively recently launched. At kind of like a product and engineering level, do you have any kind of like framing or mental model you use for like a playbook of sorts? Like some people are very organized and say like, well, this is my playbook. I think here are the three things about when I'm building a business. Or is it very organic? I know you're a very product and people oriented person. Is it organic to the problem at hand?
I think it's a super good question. I think so. Certainly for Buddy Build, it was one of those problems that we experienced as a consequence, or it's a business that we founded as a consequence of our own experience. And so we'd wrapped up this time at Amazon and wanted to get reacclimated with the iOS ecosystem. And I was building a very simple application with a couple of friends. And the application, I just wanted to be able to like, you know, push a commit, have it build, get deployed to my vice. And it was insanely difficult to get that to happen. And so when I talked to a bunch of friends through how they did that, they're like, no, this is the status quo. This is the way it should work. And I was like, that's crazy to me. And so I guess that's like kind of that intolerance for kind of mediocrity or like this pain that you have to feel as a developer. I was like, why does it have to be so hard to do this? And, you know, it's easy to look back and say, obviously, but we needed a mobile optimized CI solution. But when we started the company, it had, you know, a similar vision to that. And we weren't clear which part of the kind of overall vision would really resonate with people. So I really did get anchored with CI because that was probably the most acute pain point for most teams. And then obviously like automating the deployment process as well, making that super simple. So what's our playbook? I mean, I think, you know, from its inception, the playbook is what really sucks? Like, why is this so hard? And is it because I'm doing it wrong? Because, you know, that happens all the time. And there is actually an optimized, better way of doing things. Or is there something that's like actually systemically kind of broken? Like, should there be a solution kind of in this space? And so that's kind of the very first part of the, I don't know if I have a formal playbook that I could open up and, you know, publish or what have you. But I think the first thing is like, I feel it's really important if you can viscerally feel the frustration of the inefficiencies, I think is the way it is. One of our coworkers, you know, he didn't work with us at Buddy Build. He's Unblocked. He's one of the only people who hasn't worked with us at Buddy Build. And so him and I'd worked together a long, long time ago. And he said to me, one of the things that he observed is that I actually feel frustrated and irritated by the software that we build. Like it actually physically manifests itself and I get frustrated. And that's how we learn to like rough off, you know, rough edges or explore new directions or things of that nature. So I think you feeling it is like probably one of the most important things, I would say, from my experience.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that comes through in the software. Something that you mentioned, which I'm interested to dig into a little, is you sort of are looking, and I think a lot of people in our audience are looking at potential product areas to explore, whether it's part of a large company or they're founding something or whatever it is. And often a question comes up when you say, okay, the status quo sucks. And if you are a product-minded person, you're probably, hopefully, have some skill at looking at an experience and seeing, okay, there's some bad things about this experience. It's not as good as I imagine it could be. But often when you start digging into something and you do interviews, you talk to customers, you build an understanding of how other products in that space operate, you start to realize the systemic problems. You call those like, oh, is this systemically broken? And I had kind of evaluated the product space that Buddy Build was in, and I think some people might evaluate the same way with some of the problems that you're now facing building Unblocked, that there's inherently difficult things about it. So in the case of Buddy Build, it's like, well, part of why our toolchains suck for this is because Xcode is constantly changing and is constantly breaking, and Apple doesn't really have APIs for a bunch of stuff, and Apple maybe now doesn't even want you doing these things. And a new Xcode version could just break something subtly that no one would even understand. There's no real error message for it. And I saw I think seeing this story has reframed the way I think about this kind of problem a lot. But at that time, I told you sort of infamously, oh, Dennis, this is too hard. You don't want to build this. You're like, Xcode could just break your stuff. It's going to be really unpleasant. You're going to have a bad time. You don't want to build this. And instead of being discouraged, I saw you kind of get energized by that. So how do you think about building things with a systemically or kind of fundamentally get difficult aspect to them? Is that something that you seek out? Or is this like, well, I'm on this mission, and if it's hard, then it's just going to be hard. And if it was easy, then great. Or how do you think about that?
Yeah. So it's actually, I'm flattered. I actually remember that conversation that we had. It was at a Starbucks on Water Street in Vancouver. And, you know, I was in, in awe that I'd get to have some opportunity to spend time with you. You're, you know, a prolific person in the community. And so it was like, I was really flattered to be like, hey, we're thinking about building this thing. And your feedback was like, no, 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 this seems pretty hard. And I was like, you're right. I was energized by it. I do get energized by problems that are hard. I think all the easy problems have been solved. So like when I think of a hard problem, I was like, great. When we solve this, what that does is becomes inherently a moat. And so some problems are hard because they require a lot of patience or they require a lot of manpower. Some problems are hard because they just require a certain kind of insight or, you know, technological breakthrough, what have you. Most problems are a combination of both is kind of what it comes down to. And so for Buddy Build, I don't know, maybe it's oversimplifying it, but to me, I'm like, it's just software. Like, there should be a way to do it. Just like, there's very few things that are actually impossible. It's just a matter of time. And so I don't know. I'm just very like, I guess like focused on thinking about it that way. I'm just like, yeah, whatever. Like, it'll be hard. We'll figure it out and we'll move on.
Here's a story I tell myself and you tell me how true this is. But that pairs well though with something that I saw with Buddy Build, and I assume you're doing the same thing with Unblock, is as you're building the product, especially in the early stages, a very high willingness to talk to customers in a support context. So like when I was an early user of Buddy Build, and it's like, oh, Xcode randomly barfing on whatever, some error, I have an app bundle, something. I would text you or email you and I'd be like, hey, there's this thing. And you'd be like, oh, we'll put it into the intercom chat. And I was like, oh yeah, the little chat bubble in the corner that every web app has, but that if you actually try to interact with it, it wastes your time. You're like, no, interact with it. And so I would, and I would get like a real human, not just any human, not like a support human in some other time zone, but like one of the developers who actually knows what Xcode is and can check if the new version just came out yesterday. And sure enough, it did. And sure enough, that caused the problem. And so it trained me as an early customer to, when you are hitting up against the edges of the fundamentally hard problems, communicate with your product team in a loop to give them that feedback of, hey, it's working or it's not working, or here are the edges of it. And then for me as a customer, if it had been a fully automated, you say it's just software, but it was very much, at least at that time, software and humans. If it was just software and I was like, oh, it errored out, and then there's not really much you can do about it other than try to troubleshoot some remote system that has like a Mac Mini running Xcode that you don't even understand how it's configured, like we would just give it up on it. Mm-hmm. But do you see that as a fundamental strategy? Or again, is that one of those just, we just kind of ended up doing that? Was it incidental or fundamental, I guess, is my question.
No, it's fundamental. Like, I think that's actually super important. Even in the very last days of Buddy Build, I would still get up quite early in the morning and spend probably an hour, hour and a half on the front lines doing intercom support, answering emails, getting into our discussion forums or what have you. I think it's just like fundamentally important. Like at the very beginning of these projects, right, you basically you're testing a thesis. You're like, I have this problem. I have an experiment that I want to run. And I think, you know, your opinion for how you should solve that problem is the software that you build. And so like opinions are all nice and wonderful, but, you know, that's within your view or perspective of the world. When you go and show it to someone and then they tell you, yeah, that works, except for X, Y, and Z things, then there becomes a little bit of the art and science can mix together. We have to figure out which of those things are important. But if you don't actually talk to people and, like, you know, have the thick skin to be able to take some of the sometimes painful feedback, then, you know, you're not really improving. Like, really, in the essence, it's like the experiment has failed because that's not working for that person. You're not willing to adjust it to accommodate for its success. Now, you can say, like, well, I'm happy with the experiment failing because that's actually not the right person I want to build it for. But if you accept that that is the right customer profile, then you need to take that feedback and iterate on it. Layers of people or layers of systems or what have you between that feedback and the people who build the software, I think is like basically your first step to like building software that it lacks any kind of empathy. Like I just have, we'll see how Unblock does what have you, but in my wildest aspirations, it's, you know, change, it like helps people in a material way. And I'm still doing tech support. I still do it today. Like, I answer almost every single question that comes through intercom or, you know, a LinkedIn message or what have you, and I will reply to all of them.
Yeah, I love that. And that definitely, that's one of those things that I've talked to a lot of people who have a mental model, like, okay, you're a founder and you have to be solely focused. And so you got to make sure there aren't distractions and there aren't interruptions and there aren't, you know, you have to make sure you have a support team. Okay, we have a product, let's hire customer support people. And the default mental model, and maybe this is just me being a bit out of date and maybe this is a better known thing that I could have learned from talking to more founders or something. But I've definitely gotten the sense that there's a bit of a default mindset of like, oh, you want to send those tickets all off into a ticketing system as opposed to get this to the like senior product people in real time.
I can't remember. It was like in university or at some point I read an article where, and I don't know if they still do it or not, but Nordstrom executives have to spend some non-trivial amount of time selling shoes on the floor, right? Like they are actually people. It's like, you really have to like appreciate like every aspect of the business. I've always respected, I think, leaders who, you know, it's not scalable for, you know, if you're running 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 person company, for you to necessarily spend a huge amount of time doing customer support across all these product lines, so on and so forth. But you better be talking to people who are actually like buying the stuff that certainly you care about. Because otherwise, I don't know how you rationalize or how you reconcile what your thesis is with reality. And so you're not really solving any problem at that point.
Yeah, that's interesting. So how do you reconcile the pressures, or maybe this is just a fundamental discipline of a founder thing. How do you reconcile the pressures that having these inbound support requests coming in put on you and your team mentally when they come from as you kind of hinted at, sometimes they come from people that aren't really ever going to be customers that you're going to financially benefit from serving?
Yeah, so I think there's two parts of that question. One is there a financial like payoff to that investment that you're going to make? And the other is like, is this actually the right person whatsoever? For Buddy Build, in the very early days, we were actually talking to UX designers and product managers to be like, hey, look, we have this like easy way to get a build onto your phone. And then you could like take a screenshot and circle the area and provide some feedback to the engineering team. And so over time, we realized that like that wasn't an acute pain point. And so we stopped talking to those people. And when they would come into the door to be like, hey, I'm a product manager who's thinking about that scenario, we didn't spend a lot of time with that. We would support them or what have you, but that's not the people that we knew that we could solve the biggest pain point for. So how do we do this now in Unblocked? We're still very early on and we're still narrowing in exactly who that person is. Like there are certain characteristics. I think the real tension comes like, understanding that this person's going to be able to like contribute financially to the success of the company at some point is going to be a paying customer. That's one interesting thing. The other thing is like, to what degree do you take the feedback that they provided to you and prioritize it relative to the other things on the roadmap, right? Like, is this something that you drop everything for and immediately kind of go in and help them? Like, how do you accurately assess, is this a problem specifically for Alan or is it for Alan and Dennis and 3,000 other people?
Yeah. Related to that thread in terms of like taking in product, and the reason I'm asking you about this because this is something I've seen you do really well. So I feel like I like learning about how you think about it, and I think it's useful to other people. How do you think about going in when you're trying to get feedback on a product? So you give a demo, you're showing somebody something, either they're driving or ideally they're exploring this product. And I've seen you, what I label it as, expertly steer me to give you very honest, clear feedback, which is something that I've seen a lot of people fail at. Is there any kind of mental models or tricks or habits you use to try and get that honesty and sort of rawness from people when you're trying to get product feedback?
I don't know that it's anything I do deliberately. There's no like meta conversation I'm having to be like, okay, I'm going to ask these questions and Alan will be honest with me. I think... yeah, I don't know if there's a deliberate thing. I think it's just, I am quite earnest. Like, I'm like, I think about it very pragmatically. It is, here's what we think it's solving. Most developers tend to have pretty strong opinions. And so I'd be like, is this solve the problem for you? It's like, no, you didn't think about X, Y, and Z things. And so I think maybe as a consequence of the nature of the problem space, we tend to get like pretty kind of direct feedback. But I don't know that I'm like consciously aware of it. My goal is to be like empathetic and come across in earnest, very curious about if this thing would actually work for you. And more, if it does, great. But I'm genuinely more interested if it doesn't. Like I'm hyper-focused on the critical feedback or the things where we're deficient. If it's working, I'm like, oh, great, great. Like that part of the experiment works. Fine. Let's go figure out why it doesn't work over here.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's an interesting... I love that explanation, even though it's maybe slightly as useful as like, oh, here's the trick I use. But what it points to is if being and adopting wholly, being fundamentally curious and inquisitive about the deficiencies and the problems in your product, which you're sort of wired naturally for, I think my weakness that I've been growing, I think I've been growing out of over the years, is that I'm wired to want to polish everything and make everything perfect. And I think I grew up with a little bit too much pride in the software I would make, which had some good outcomes that I would make these really nice things. But then of course I would launch something and then you can make a really beautiful thing nobody pays for. And that like helps nobody and you really accomplish nothing. And you're not a business anymore. And so that's something that I think I saw in you when you would seek feedback from the products. But I mean, in contrast to a lot of the other, I've talked to a lot of startups over the years trying to ask me for feedback. And often I guess I got the sense that not everybody really wants to hear how bad it is and where the real pain points are. They're going into those conversations probably unconsciously looking for validation. And you go into those conversations looking for me to poke holes in and criticize.
Yeah, you're actually particularly good at it. It's every time I prepare, I have relatively thick skin, but I have to put on another layer when I send it to you. But I appreciate it because I'm like, if I can get to that level of polish, I know like, you know, it's like, it's quite commendable. It is definitely one of the things where, yeah, I think I'm just wired to like really understand how people work and why the thing that we're hopefully helping you solve doesn't work. Like that's the thing I'm super focused on or fascinated by. Like, again, it's an opinion that's really formulated or manifested within this software. And so if my opinion is wrong, I'd love to understand, like have a conversation about it. Like let's learn and see how we can improve it.
I love it. So you've used some of these various kind of mental models and approaches for building Buddy Build over 3 years, built this product from the idea in the coffee shop of why is this so hard to the team of how big did the team end up getting at this peak?
I want to say like 60-ish people, maybe a little bit more. Yeah.
Which is pretty good for 0 to 60 in 3 years. Acquired by Apple. That went how it went. Now you're on doing your next venture, which you recently launched, which is Unblocked. I'll give you sort of an opportunity to like describe Unblocked briefly in your own words, and then I'd be curious to know what things you have taken from Buddy Build that you're maybe doing differently versus what things you've doubled down on in terms of culture, engineering, habits, and all this kind of stuff.
Sure. So Unblocked at the highest level, what we're trying to do is contextualize a code base with all the information that exists in places that you talk about your code so that you can get answers for things that otherwise block you from making progress. So if you think about it, you know, if you're thinking about fixing a bug or implementing a new feature, a lot of the times you might not necessarily know how the application was built or why it works a certain way. You know, I said the other day, I think, to a couple of friends, I'm like, I see a lot of these demos where they say file new project. And there's very few times that you actually get to like do file new project. You're almost always inheriting a code base that's been around for a long time. And so the hard part isn't necessarily writing the code to implement the feature or fix the bug. Where you spend a lot of your time is trying to understand like all the context as to like why the application works the way it does, who the best person is to talk to, when these changes were introduced, and like contextualize it so that you can make those changes. And so that's what Unblocked basically tries to do, is give you a way to get that information in a very natural way, either by asking questions or, you know, being in the IDE and actually seeing information that's specific to the files that you're kind of looking at.
Yeah, I love that description. And I love that in your description, you followed what I strongly encourage people's best practice, which is you didn't mention AI at all.
Yeah, I don't know. It's so strange to me. Like the AI stuff is like, again, I'm a very pragmatic person. I can't imagine running around the streets saying, guess what, everyone? I use DynamoDB. DynamoDB is the database that I use. My company's inherently worth way more money because I use DynamoDB. It's a technology. You know what I mean?
Like your users don't care what technology you solves the problem.
Now, I think it is like, to its credit, like I think there's a lot of froth around the AI stuff these days. But to the degree that you can replicate human behavior with software, I think you find pretty good outcomes. And so I think there's a very natural way that people work. If you and I were working on a team and I had a question, I'd probably send you a Slack message or tap you on the shoulder and ask you that question. That's insane if you think about the lack of efficiency there, right? Because if you're in the middle of something, your context is now gone. I think we've all experienced being interrupted while we have something complicated in our head. It's also painful for me because I have to wait for you to like get back to me. So I was like, well, that question behavior is definitely kind of the way that I think most people learn. how do we get answers based on that question? And so this AI wave is actually really, really good at replicating that behavior. And so that's what we're trying to build ultimately as kind of like the cornerstone. Now, if that was, you know, if that could have been done with like a fancy Postgres hybrid search with some others, sure, we would have done that too. But like this one seems to be, this technology seems to unlock this very natural workflow. So, but it's not an AI, it's just, it's the underlying technology that makes the workflow possible. No one cares. No one should care.
Right. I love it. And I will continue to celebrate when I see companies building things with AI that describe themselves in context of the user value and not and the problem and not any technology they're using to build it. So you're building on Block and you're live now and people can sign up. And it's my sense is I'm sure it's still, as you mentioned, still evolving, but especially kind of like medium to larger software teams disproportionately will benefit from this sort of latent knowledge of the code base. If you have a large code base, you're probably going to get more out of it than if, you know, it's an indie developer wrote it all themselves, probably does not have a lot of times they get blocked on someone else, obviously. And so you're building this business that is in some ways shares a lot of the shape of a business as to BuddyBuild. There's a bunch of the same team, definitely. But then also you're building things for developers. You're helping people solve problems in their software development workflows. And you have a couple of fundamentally hard problems that are associated with that. What, if anything, have you taken from your experience at BuddyBuild and then you're now doing differently with Unblocked about how you're sort of approaching the team building culture, habits, process? Or is it all just kind of like, yeah, let's do that again and keep tweaking as we go?
Yeah, I think it's easy to figure out things that you did wrong because those are the ones that leave like the most scars, right? Mm. So you just look back at your body and be like, ooh, that really hurts. How do we make sure we don't do that again? And I think some of those things, you know, we're still a small team. Some of those things we won't actually really appreciate until we grow the team besides the core team that it is that did build BuddyBuild. So Unblocked, there's 11 of us. 10 of the 11 have worked together for the better part of a decade, right? So it is very much the same team. We have our cultural predispositions. And so I'm sure there's a bunch of blind spots we're not going to realize until the team's like 20 or 50 or 100 people or what have you, if we're so lucky. You know, pragmatically, some of the things that we've done differently, I did a very, very bad job of celebrating wins. Like it was, you know, zero to, you know, inception to acquisition in 3 years, but felt like 12, right? Because I worked 70 to 80 hour works weeks. I remember after selling the company on a Saturday, getting out of the shower and being like, what do people do on Saturdays if they don't go into the office? I'd been so conditioned at that point. And so that kind of evolved into like, really not, you know, we crossed our first $1 million in annual recurring revenue. And it's like, it's a pretty monumental thing to say like, hey, we have this thesis, here's an opinion, and now people are giving us $1 million a year in perpetuity. And people are telling their friends and like, you know, that's, and all I was thinking about is like, yeah, but here are all the things that are wrong. And so it was really important that we actually take the time to celebrate some of these wins, like, you know, memorialize it in many ways. And so I try to be a little bit more deliberate in celebrating that with the team. And, you know, I certainly set slightly different boundaries for myself. Like I don't work on Saturdays, typically. I try to stay away from kind of a lot of digital devices on Saturdays. And, you know, I just shifted that to Sundays. But, you know, the idea is that. But, yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, I heard it a million times. This is a marathon, not a sprint. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And my internal response is sometimes if I didn't vocalize it is like, why can't you run a marathon at a sprint pace? You know what I mean? I was like, let's just see if you can. And you can, but man, you're really beat up at the end of it for sure.
It has a high cost. It's one of those things I see a lot of people in a lot of contexts to say, well, we're going to do this at all costs. But then you find out what the all costs were. And then it's like,
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, it's good to hear that you're working less than 80 hours a week now.
Yeah.
Or at least you've strongly implied that. And it sounds like, I think it makes a lot of sense, obviously, when you're an 11-person team, you can get away with, you can probably have almost any set of cultural practices. And if you have a team that's done that for a long time, you can probably be effective. I'm curious, though, to kind of zoom in with the time that we have left into the kind of topic of building teams and building cultures and product cultures. Given the perspective you have, you know, you've started these startups, you've worked at Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, and these large companies that have their own quite different cultures in some ways, but then also probably, I would imagine from your perspective, some similar good and bad ways of looking about things from being the size that they are. So I'd be curious to try like a little bit of a, I don't want to say quick fire round, but just like loop through a few topics and see if you have any thoughts on things that you've learned, that things that you find work particularly well on small versus large teams, or that you find, I don't know, lessons learned. You've told me before that you have no recurring meetings except your daily stand-up in the morning and then the one you and I have to for coffee.
That's right.
Do you feel like that's like a quirk of you and the team that you've built around you, that you can get away with that? Is this a philosophical thing? Do you think everyone else is just maybe misguided in having as many recurring meetings as probably most of the people in this listening have more than one recurring meeting a week?
Yeah, so I think there's obviously a point in time, right? We're relatively small. Things are well-defined. We don't need a lot of like communication paths or what have you. We're all sitting in the same room. We can get stuff done. But I think it's an interesting exercise. If you are a person who has a lot of recurring meetings, when you go on vacation or you step away from those meetings, did you actually miss anything? And if you haven't, then you probably should stop going. Like, they probably don't need to exist. I think meetings are like really, really good to like solve a problem for a very specific point in time, but ad infinitum seems kind of unnecessary. You know, we'll have let's say a quarterly board meeting, completely reasonable because we're solving a specific problem over a long period of time. But you know what I mean? It changes every time. A weekly one-on-one stand-up meeting, you know, I suspect if that's happening, it's probably because of a performance issue that needs to be addressed, right? It's like, I don't know of something that needs to be met every single day, Tuesday at 2 o'clock. I think that's, you know, potentially, I'm sure there's like lots of counterexamples, but for me, what's that expression? Like, the time will grow to fill the meeting will grow to fill the time allotted to it or what have you. And so I don't like unnecessarily like having these conversations. I think one of the best things that we do in our meetings or like my kind of is like, we start off every conversation by saying, what's the problem that we're trying to solve? And like, if it starts to deviate from that problem, we snap back to that specific problem. Once that problem is solved, go back and, you know, solve it.
When you are in these larger organizations, and to say larger organization is an understatement because it's literally like more than 1,000 times larger than the team that you're on right now.
Yeah.
Were you able to effectively scale back on having those recurring meetings? Because like a lot of the large companies, I don't know exactly, but of course, every large company is a quilt of a whole bunch of different subcultures rather than just one monolith, the way that people maybe think about it. But a lot of companies will have sort of soft rules, which is like, oh, you should have some recurring one-on-one with your direct reports. Like Andy Grove would say, it's a fireable offense if you don't have a recurring one-on-one with all your direct reports. Were you able to get away with like at least having within your team saying, okay, well, our team has minimal to almost no recurring meetings, and it's just the recurring meetings are the ones that are outside our org? Or is it kind of like once you're at that scale that maybe you do, the recurring meetings do have a fulfill a necessary evil to keep everybody aligned in terms of communication and coordination and habits?
One-on-one meetings with direct reports, that's actually something that I believe solves a real problem. I want to make sure that like that person is like feeling good about their job. They know what to prioritize. They have an opportunity for us to kind of connect. Like that seems super reasonable. If there's other ways that that information can be conveyed and it's not 30 minutes or 60 minutes every week, then I don't know why you wouldn't explore that. Again, I think there's also this weird social predisposition where people feel like if they are invited to a meeting that they need to attend it, even if it's not helpful. As recently as yesterday, one of the engineers on the team is trying to get something done. He's like, I'm not going to attend this thing because I really want to focus on that. And he was kind of sheepish about it. And I was like, absolutely. Yes, 100%. You should absolutely do that. I was the one who kind of called the meeting. We're trying to solve these kind of series of problems. He's like, this isn't what I think I should be spending my time on. And I'm like, yeah, you're absolutely right. So like, go work on that thing. We'll figure out this and loop you in if we need to.
Yeah, I think that's probably not controversial, is that you should try to build a culture, or maybe it is, but I don't think it's controversial. You should try to build a culture where people feel like they should know about meetings.
I don't think it's controversial. I think it's really hard to do. I think, you know what I mean? Like if you have like a regular staff meeting and you're just like, this is not an effective use of my time, and you don't show up to that staff meeting, well, like what signal does that send to the other people? Like you guys are wasting my time, right? So it's like, how do you balance those two things? Like, how do you actually say like, hey, this isn't super helpful? So you can either realign or try to fix the trajectory of the meeting, or you can be seen kind of as an ass, right? And you're just like not showing up anymore. And so, you know, usually it's approach one and then approach two if it doesn't work.
Yeah, okay, I like that. I enjoy any interesting mental model that people have for challenging the quantity of meetings, because so many of my discontinuities where my job or my effectiveness or my life got better is when the number of meetings I had decreased. So yeah. I'm always looking for new crowbars.
For sure.
How do you think about the term product management?
That's such an open-ended question. I like the term product management. What do you think of the term product management? That seems like a good term. Yeah, I like
it. Let's manage some products.
Yeah, yeah. Those products won't manage themselves.
Yeah, the reason I ask is, like, the sense I get is that in orgs large and small, it's one of the roles with the highest variance in how it operates and the impact it has in different organizations, even within a company. And so most teams the size of 11, founder-led startups, don't have a product manager title. And that's like pretty standard. And I know that's the case at everybody. But something that I find interesting is talking to founders who have gone through an acquisition loop or they have worked at large companies. I hear widely varying opinions about the sort of role, the ideal role and the value that product management as a function, people whose formal title is product management, think of themselves as having a career in product management bring. I hear some people take an argument that it's like, oh, it's the backbone of an organization and that, you know, having people who have a founder mindset that have a vision for a product in a lot of ways that can be like really effective as product managers is kind of almost like the founders of the sub products within an org. And then I've heard arguments that modern product management is mostly just a scheme or a scam, and that really it's an excuse for ceremony, and that engineers should be the ones owning the spec and actually talking to the customers. And if you were answering enough intercom messages, you wouldn't need product managers, and then everything kind of in between. So I was wondering whether or not you have any sort of thoughts or feelings on that role and how we build our teams and cultures around that, because it's one of the levers, I think, that when you're building a product and engineering org, there's a lot of consideration, I guess a lot of latitude in how you kind of build and organize your product management function.
Yeah. So to me, I saw product management and program management, like sometimes those terms are used interchangeably at Microsoft, Amazon, and Apple in different incantations. I think the success scenario is, and I've seen it across those organizations, almost irrespective of what the name of that role is someone who is very clear as to like what's the problem that people are trying to solve. Not how it should be implemented, but what it should do, what the relative priorities are. And then when things kind of get like confusing, provide clarity around that relative to like what the priorities are and what it should do. I find the failure scenarios are people who are just like effectively running a process like, okay, let's go through the bugs and have no understanding of what the bugs are. I think we used to call them checkbox PMs. So they would just like check the items on the list and provide really like very little value to the actual evolution of the product or what have you. So to me, yeah, I think you call them as like little founders. I've heard of them as mini CEOs. But I think people who can provide clarity as to like what we're trying to build, why we're trying to build it, and what order it should be done, that's an incredible product manager. That's a really hard thing to do though, because you generally need to have some deep domain experience in certainly two of those three things. Mm-hmm. Could you take a product manager who's like, I don't know, focused on, I don't know, choose something arbitrarily like payments and stick them into dev tools and say like this person can be, you know, productive, or e-commerce and go into dev tools? They might be able to get one or maybe two of those things, but unless you've actually kind of feel the pain or you've spent a lot of time building software, it's probably going to be hard for you to really empathize with what should be built. I also find one of like the third rails that product managers touch is they tell engineers how something should actually go and get implemented. Mm. Most engineers, that is kind of the, you know, building software is both an art and a science. And so when someone tells you what paintbrush to pick up, which paint, and like how to apply it onto the canvas, I don't know. It doesn't feel like that's a very satisfying job, especially if they're wrong. I don't know. I think to your question, like, should you have engineers answering intercom? I think there is definitely value in someone who sits in between an engineering organization and a whole bunch of customer feedback, can synthesize it, knows based on what we're trying to accomplish, what needs to be done, can you know, relatively prioritize it and then help the engineering team kind of go define and implement that such that the customers are happy.
One thing, and I think I can guess what your answer this is going to be, but we mentioned that you do daily stand-ups, and that's like part of your development process ceremony that you do at Unblocked. And I assume that you also did that at Buddybuild. Are there any other sort of habits or ceremonies or process things that you feel like, you know, hold water, pay for themselves in terms of the effort, or is that kind of the one heartbeat?
I think there's like many processes. Like, we do start with every meeting by saying like, what's the problem we're trying to solve? And like, that's kind of a variant, honestly, of what Amazon I think still does, which is like, before every meeting gets kicked off, they have printed out piece of paper, or they read, you know, some short document to help align everyone as to like what this conversation is going to be about. That's one of those kind of mini processes that we do, you know, kind of on the feel good, nice side. It is nice to like, on a sunny day in Vancouver, which exists, to like go out as a team and like decompress for a little bit, like sit in a patio somewhere or something to that end. In terms of like the day-to-day engineering processes, I mean, the other one is like, yeah, what are you going to do? And then the more valuable one is like, when something didn't work, like you took longer than you expected or something failed, you know, those postmortems are insanely important. Like, making the same mistake twice is just almost unforgivable in my mind, right? Like, there's no excuse for it. Like, if you've identified it and then you do it again, oh, like, why?
Do you call them postmortems or debriefs or retros, or not that it matters what you call them?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I can use that language on a podcast. But oh. Yeah. We do some variant of that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Some variant of that. Yeah.
I love it. What are the biggest, if you can think of any, biggest weaknesses or gaps that you've seen at large companies that make them potentially vulnerable to competition from startups and more nimble, smaller companies?
Oh, yeah. Lots of gaps.
Yeah, so, I know. That's why I figured you have to answer this.
What's the difference between a big company and a small company? One of the biggest differences, I should say, is like at a big company, you get 100% or near 100% distribution the moment you talk about it. Like, at time equals zero, you ship that product, there's tens of millions of people or hundreds of millions of people using it. At a startup, what you get is zero distribution, and you have to like beg and plead, and hopefully someone will use it and maybe tell a couple of friends, and like it slowly starts to build a flywheel. But what you have to do is like, you have thousands of people that you need to kind of coordinate in order to get that system built. Whereas in a startup, you can probably build that exact same system. Well, I know definitively you can build that exact same system with far less people. You know, I think one of the advantages that of being in a small company is that you get to have a spectrum of responsibility and can really build compelling things very, very, very quickly. And then you have to take on the onus of like, you know, highlighting or making sure the world knows about it. Whereas like, you're a big company, and often, I don't know, it's honestly like just maybe a handful of examples, but overwhelmingly the software that most big companies ship is not particularly compelling. Often it looks a lot like other software that smaller companies have shipped. And so I don't know, like I prefer to like be like in small companies or small groups of people that are empowered to like ship high quality software or software that people love. As opposed to like a really big company where you make a whole bunch of people feel meh.
But you can do it at scale on day one.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Dennis. This has been awesome. I know we could talk, and we will talk for hours more over time. But for today, that is our show. Where can people go more to find out about more about you and your work?
GetUnblocked.com is certainly the URL that you can go and learn about the company. We want people to get unblocked, so we like that domain. If you want to, my last name is long, but it's Dennis Pilarinos on Twitter. You can reach me there, or you can just email me, dennis@getunblocked.com. Like I said, I do reply, as long as it's like you're not trying to sell me something I don't need. I reply to like every email, and I've always done that. So as far as I remember, if I haven't, then let me know. Thank you so much for having me. Like I said, I still hold you as one of those people that I deeply respect their perspectives and opinions. And so I'm very flattered to be on the show. Thanks for asking me.
Well, thanks, Dennis. You're too kind. Same to you. Thanks for being on the show. It Shipped That Way is brought to you by SteamClock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with SteamClock. That's it for today. You can give us feedback, follow us on social media, or rate the show by going to itshipped.fm/contact. Until next time, keep shipping.